Welcome to Curated Conversations, a podcast discussing real-world issues of equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging. I'm your host, Shaliza Jamal, founder of Curated Leadership, an organization that fosters partnerships with individuals and companies to develop their knowledge in the areas of equity and diversity to build inclusive communities. Joining me for episode 21 is Pradeep Singh Nagram. Pradeep is a collector of antique cars and riding motorcycles. I've seen them firsthand. He voluntarily serves as director of the Sikh Heritage Museum of Canada and is an avid historian and artifact collector, including over 2,000 Sikh toy soldiers. He also serves on the board of trustees of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights and is committed to reconciliation. His love of the three-stripe brand and sports, aka Adidas, by the way, for those folks who don't know three stripes, has led to many interesting athletic accomplishments, including being a high school tennis champion, an elite ball hockey player, qualifying for the Boston Marathon, and being a national level boxer for which a Hollywood movie, Tiger, was produced based on his journey. He's been featured in many school textbooks, and you may be interested to know that he specializes in employee engagement, inclusive workplace strategies, equity and diversity work, as well as serving as a member of the senior team for the Halton District School Board as their human rights equity advisor. Pradeep, welcome. I'm so excited that we're finally sitting down. I can't believe it took us to episode 21 to get here. Welcome, welcome, welcome. How are you doing today?
Well, that's a good number to start. I like 21.
Yes, I know you do.
Boy, you're Somming Maple Leaf Days, number 21.
And it's Mila's birthday, 21.
There you go. There you go. So it's a lucky number for us.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, you recently celebrated 50 years in Canada. And of course, on January 1st, completed another polar bear dip to bring in the new year. So congratulations to that. And, you know, in your bio and through your exhibit that you recently had, you talk about continuing to live out this Canadian dream and struggle. Tell me what this means to you.
Well, you know, when we talk about Canadian dream and, you know, whatever nationality you have, you talk about the American dream or some other country itself. And so what does it mean for us, Canada? What's the Canadian dream, right? The Canadian dream is to be a productive Canadian, you know, take care of what Maslow's hierarchy of needs are, relatively speaking, right? And once you got that, what's your responsibility around civic engagement, around charitable work, around humanitarian work? Really, you know, that's what we should be aspiring to as Canadians, right? And then the struggle is that we can't just live on our laurels, so to speak, and pat ourselves to define who we are as a country and then make our definition relative to another country. Well, we're better than, or look at that, or, you know, at least we, and we start using these nuanced language to kind of justify who and what we are, but not necessarily holding ourselves accountable to our own shortcomings as a country. And so the Canadian struggle means that no matter how we see, how we rank on the world rankings or any other point of measure that we use to define who we are and how we're moving forward, you know, as a nation and globally, there's also that responsibility of doing our own checks and balances. And that's where the struggle comes in. And, you know, the most poignant one today facing all Canadians or anybody living in Canada is reconciliation. And to think that that continues to be a struggle, to be able to get Canadians, first of all, really owning the concept and spirit of truth and reconciliation, and then really taking action on those aspects, right? Because reconciliation is just not a theoretical framework, and it requires us to be engaged as Canadians. And the struggle is just not in terms of reconciliation and issues facing the Indigenous community. We got other systemic issues as well as a country and as a nation. And we have to be able to hold account. And that's where the concept of so-called putting ourselves in the struggle, right? The struggle for social justice, the struggle for equality, the struggle for equity. Those are all important struggles for which we must always, always be engaged in. You know, not being in, you know, speaks to those terms of being indifferent or complicit. then with what's happening around us. That's what that term means for me. It means being I'm an active and engaged Canadian while I'm pursuing my well-being and growth independently and as a family or as a community. I also have a wider responsibility to the wider community, the province, and the country, and then even globally.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because oftentimes we separate these things, or we think, you know, especially, you know, sometimes people of color who are have not been in Canada for centuries think, oh, reconciliation has something to do with me. But I really appreciate that you talked about that, that being Canadian is caring about reconciliation and doing that work of untangling it and working through that struggle. So I really appreciate that.
Any issue when we come to Canada, whether we're a newcomer, a recent arrival, have lived in Canada, left and come back, our country is our responsibility. It's no one else's mm-hmm. responsibility. Mm-hmm. Our issues are our responsibility. It's not somebody else's, right? And when I talk about that struggle, like I said, there's within the country, and sometimes you'll hear news clippings, you know, Canada struggles on the international stage. So what does that look like, right? What's that accountability? What position do we hold to be able to address issues? Because, you know, as Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So we can't have two sets of values, one for us in Canada and a different one globally. And if we're firm on, for example, issues around human rights, then we're firm on human rights anywhere. And we'll stand up and challenge violations in our own country and shortcomings, and we'll challenge those internationally, because we have a role internationally. The countries sign different accords, and there's things called international aid, and there's global responsibilities, whether it's part of being part of the G7 nations, whether it's being part of the UN or any other declarations that we sign, right? Tells us that we also have a global responsibility.
So I have a question here that it's been coming up in my mind as you're talking is, you know, you've got this personal responsibility, you believe in this. How do we move other people along? Because there isn't a collective understanding that reconciliation or human rights globally and locally should be our responsibility. How do we ingrain that? How do folks ingrain that in themselves? How do we teach that so that folks do care?
There's two parts. They're, depending on what kind of conversations we have, are we too busy in our social lives and our family lives, and we just want to talk about the latest Instagram or TikTok? And so it's also how we ourselves prioritize of what's critical and what's important and what we allow to be important in our lives. And so that's one of the starting points, right? That these issues, we can't separate them. And the minute that we can be immune from caring, like I said, and be indifferent about it, then other things we're going to be taking priority. So that's one thing as a starting point that's critical. And I think that's why when you shared what you shared as part of the intro, all of that manifests in every single aspect of who and what I am at any given time. My 50-year exhibit, I spoke about Nimi and water, the title of the whole exhibit, you know, from the five rivers to the five lakes, was about this concept of water itself, and then what it means for the Indigenous community, what it means around reconciliation, what it means for them to be able to even access, and what is it that we're doing to the water in Canada to even access around clean drinking water, et cetera. You're going to experience part of that as part of my journey. I can't separate those pieces. And so that's one aspect. I think it's absolutely critical as part of the educational system. And I know they have courses now, for example, a grade 10 civics course. And I'm actually featured in one of those textbooks. I know that they have changed, I think, the grade 11 English curriculum to be less ethnocentric and more relevant, and I think very specifically Indigenous related. So these aspects are starting to bring to the forefront some of these critical issues for people to have a better consciousness of what's happening. Because, you know, we always say out of sight is out of mind. And out of mind is out of mind in terms of if nothing's ever talked about, engaged, or even spoken of. And so those are some parameters as well for which we have responsibility. And so, you know, it requires this type of work, just like when there are critical issues going on, you look at issues regarding missing and murdered Indigenous women, right? And you look at the Red Dress campaign. These are things that take so much energy just to bring it in front of our eyes, to have it front and center regularly within the media, within articles, within other scopes. And you know, you're, like I said, we're competing now. We're competing with these critical issues with just other aspects of life where people are spending way too much time and energy on without being productive. And that's the other question when you ask, right? What does it mean to be Canadian? Do we talk about not being American? Do we talk about other concepts versus really authentically what does it mean, which applies to all Canadians? So even the language that we use is important as part of these conversations.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because it's you know, for me, when I'm hearing you, it's like being Canadian means we are actively doing the work of reconciliation. And as you said, critical to have these conversations that we just don't see Red Dress Day, for example, go by without having a conversation. Hey, do you know what this is? Have you ever thought about this? You know, maybe sharing some statistics or whatever it is, or hey, I don't know about it. Let's go learn about it.
And also not leaving it for a day.
Yes.
Right. So Red Dress is something we're speaking about right now and doesn't have to technically be on Rest Day. Red Dress Day is that time for us to be able to hold account and reflect so that we can, during the year, like we're having a conversation right now, be able to be speaking about those issues, because those issues are not a single day issue,
right?
They're still current, they're still relevant, and they must always be spoken about, engaged about, discussed about, right?
Yeah.
So that's the other aspect of this, absolutely.
And I think that's the problem, because I think that there's been an effort to highlight issues through days of significance or even months of significance. But I find what happens then is that individuals, people, companies, corporates, whatever, they forget about those issues outside of that. And I think I'm really glad that you brought that point up, because we do have to be thinking about things beyond a day or a month, right?
Yeah, well, and that's what always happens, because initially it's great because it brings heightened awareness. The minute it gets stuck and left to the day, it actually marginalizes the issue.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? It marginalizes the month. If Islamic Heritage Month, Sikh Heritage Month, Hindu Heritage Month, Jewish Heritage Month, Black History Month, Indigenous or Pride Month, you know, you look at these aspects, initially there's an uptake, an upswing of energy, ideas, resources. And then when they get just clustered in, and then that's all they are, and that's all when you can think of people, right? And I've given this example because I've lived this example, that the only time most people, an institution, an organization, is going to think about Black people is during Black History Month. Can I bring in a speaker? As if Black people can only speak during the month of February, as if they're not valued enough to speak any time of the year on any issue, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where the marginalization of these days and months come in, right? And it's actually dangerous, because if it's initially introducing you to speakers and artists and creators and excellence within the Black community, and then you can use those resources, those materials, that knowledge, that network, and use it for the other 11 months, that's when it becomes of value, mm-hmm. right? And that's the way we need to. Right. And then the other aspect, when you're talking about what else we need to do, here's another example. And I've shared this when I was teaching courses as well at the college level. And I'm not scared to mince my words on this piece. You know, I challenged the students and I said, so it was February, second semester. And I said, so what have you been doing for Black History Month? Mm-hmm. And they all kind of, students looked at me with this just glare on their eyes, like, what do you mean, what am I doing for Black History Month? And I said, yeah, what are you doing for Black History Month? Do you think Black History Month is only for the Black community to find out how Black they are? No. And we all have that onus and responsibility to engage, to learn, to be part of, to share, right? To listen, to celebrate. And so those things are critical. Those things are critical. And you know who the biggest barriers to that type of engagement is? Ourselves. If I just take the example of myself as a Sikh Canadian, no one has ever denied any non-Sikh to engage and celebrate with the Sikh community during Sikh Heritage Month, or even do something for Sikh Heritage Month, right? Because, you know, like create something, an artist creates something, right? A non-Sikh artist creates something related or reflected of Sikhism or the Sikh community in Canada. Who's stopping you? What's stopping you?
And there is that individual responsibility, right, to come towards that collective. And I think that folks always, you know, in society, we're looking for someone else to tell us or someone else to, you know, bring us to that water, so to speak. So,
and there's nothing complicated. Oh, I didn't know. You didn't know, or are you not searching?
Right.
Because if you just search the character image, you'll find out when it is. You can just Google whatever funny catchwords you want to use. Sick Heritage Month in Ontario, Sick Heritage Month in Peel, Sick Heritage Month in Brampton, Sick Heritage Month in Toronto. And you can start seeing things and mm-hmm. contacts and ideas. And within, I would say, 21 seconds, because it's episode 21. Yeah. So let's just say 21 seconds, you can have more than you can handle at your fingertips. Absolutely. To decide to which journey and where you want to go and what you want to explore more or what you want to think about.
Absolutely. Everything is there, especially with internet, right? Especially with you talked about IG and TikTok, right? Everything is there. And, you know, we think about this work and, you know, about the barriers that exist. We talk about, you know, barriers we might face information, and a lot of those are not here anymore because we have information at our fingertips. So we can attend events, we can do the work. And I think it's about, like you said, engaging people or activating that interest and that commitment, like you said, come from education, so the education system and exposure, as you talked about, as well as us having those critical conversations. And I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, for sure.
And you've been breaking barriers for many decades and in many spaces, and you even have a movie made about you and your boxing career, Tiger, which I absolutely loved. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the intersections of your work in human rights and sports? And perhaps even how that led to you filing an Ontario human rights complaint against the Canadian Amateur Boxing Association.
Well, I have to first of all be honest and tell you that human rights and sports has been as old as both human rights and sports. So there's nothing new. It's nothing that I created. It's nothing that's just unique to me and my experience. You can go back to the Jesse Owens time period in terms of some of these pieces. You can go back to the early days of hockey in Canada and the Black Hockey Leagues and the discrimination against them. You can look at early days of baseball and the discrimination against Indigenous players in the 1800s and 1900s, right? You know, you can look at just participation of women in sports. And so, you know, sports is not immune to these realities of human rights, and human rights doesn't have a wall or a barrier that gets disregarded once you enter a sport, right? Or play a sport, right? Those things are intertwined. You know, you have other role models and mentors when you're looking at this work, right? Jackie Robinson, you look at all the Black athletes from the 60s and 70s, even from the NBA, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and his work, along with many other Black athletes supporting Muhammad Ali during his challenges and struggles. You look at Nelson Mandela, who was a boxer and a lawyer, and the work that he's done. And so, you know, and I remember, I think, 2015 Year of the Sport in Canada, there was also a Roma boxer, which sometimes they get referred to as gypsies. And so sometimes there's within the community and ownership of that word, and sometimes it can be seen as derogatory or marginalizing. And so I frame that within both, there is a context within the community that gets framed, or as a reference point to identify if somebody doesn't necessarily understand the concept of Roma people. And that story was shared with my story at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. And so you don't think on the surface sometimes, you just want to be an athlete, you just want to play, you just want to participate, you just want to engage. I think as we've been sharing, human rights is just part of my fabric. I didn't think that one of the biggest battles I was going to have to fight within the concept of human rights was technically outside of the ring, but in order to get in the ring. That's where that one was landing with respect to me being allowed to compete as a boxer in Ontario and then in Canada and for Canada. And like I said, you know, these aspects of human rights, it was no different than me serving with Peel Regional Police as an auxiliary constable and, you know, Baltair Singh Dillon and the RCMP and the Turban case, right, that then manifests itself out to local police forces and what have you, and those challenges and struggles. And then, you know, being as part of industries and stuff like that, when we're looking at student outcomes within the educational system that I serve in, you know, within policing, looking at what sometimes is referred to as over-policing or disproportionate policing or disproportionate outcomes. And there's days when the big word used to be carding and stuff like that. right? Or any other aspects in terms of that aspect, or any other institutions, right? In terms of their service delivery models, or even how they're functioning as an organization. What's their demographics? What does their C-suite look like, right? And so, you know, there's no aspect of society that human rights has not come into, right? Environment is a human rights issue, right? Water is a human rights, right? Displacement is a human rights. Times of war, you talk about human rights violations. All these are aspects at the end of the day of concepts and of human rights. And so really, you know, there's no segment of society, whether we speak about sport or any other aspect. And so I can't think that my human rights work is being done in sports and there's nowhere else because human rights doesn't exist anywhere else in terms of violations or something like that, right? You know, it could be even just how a municipality or province or a region carries itself and looks after its vulnerable people, right? That can be human rights issues. And so this is the lens that human rights exists in our world to make it a better place for all.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that because it's wherever there's humans, there needs to be human rights, right? We consider that. And sometimes we think, oh, we're just playing a game. We're just playing sports and there's nothing to be considered there, right?
And I think if you heard, for me, human rights goes even beyond humans.
Yeah.
Right? It's the environment.
Climate, animals.
Climate, environment. Even animals, rights, right? Like I know we use the word for animal rights and human rights, and we don't use human rights for animals, but the concept of rights, and you apply it to environmental rights and stuff like that, speak to the concept of humanity and dignity, and those principles apply themselves in so many different aspects. Absolutely.
And for the listeners who don't know about Pradeep and the Canadian Amateur Boxing Association, I believe the controversy was around they didn't want you to be able to box because of your beard, because they talked about it as a health and safety risk. But if we look at that...
Well, you're just giving away the Trivia Pursuit question now.
Oh, shoot. But like, I think it's important to talk about because folks might not think about sports as this nuanced thing. And we might say, oh, but like the beard is a health and safety concern. But no, that's deeply systemically rooted in, you know, racism and oppression. And where do these rules come from? And sometimes it does take someone to say, hey, this is happening. This is not right. Like, for example, someone close to me loves to work, right? And she's over 65. And so she loves to work, she's working, and she wanted to take a sick day. And this rule of this organization was that if you're 70 or above, you don't get sick days. And this was something that was put into the union, who knows how long ago. But if she didn't want to take a sick day and didn't happen to be 70, no one would have realized. They said, we didn't even know this was a rule, a regulation. So in the same way, I'm just thinking like, if no one brought this to their attention, we don't always have these conversations and maybe we wouldn't have been able to change anything. But, you know, because you brought this forward, it paved the way for other people. And that's why we have to have these conversations and have the education. And like you said, center human rights in everything that we do and say and think
about. Yeah, and it's always interesting, you know, the naysayers and stuff like that, they'll say, well, you know the rules and why you need to change the rules. And yeah, that's a safety issue or all these pieces. And no one ever steps back to really look at, how could my beard be any more dangerous than the sport of boxing in of itself when I got gloves on and the whole objective of the sport is to punch the other opponent, either in the face, on the body, knock them out and knock them down possibly. And you're talking about the safety of a beard, right? And then, you know, you look at the concept that it's a contact sport and you look at mixed martial arts, you look at other boxing matches, even on a professional level, and you'll see beards all over the place. So now what is the critical issue, right? And what happens if there's a street fight and somebody has a beard? Do they say, no, we can't have a fight because that's a safety issue, right? So, you know, when you start really like peeling it off, but that's the challenge we have. People want to hold positions without taking a step back, reflecting, listening, asking. Why would this person be? What's happening? What are the origins? Why were they there in the first place? And it had, you know, in my case, is a classic example of that the origins of beards and boxing was from the old British King's Order of Rules of how does a boxer present himself. Strictly aesthetics had nothing to do with the safety. They've been around like 80 years, 90 years. And so then once they get challenged, then it becomes relatively a safety issue because they allow mustaches, allow sideburns and everything else. So how could my beard and the hair off my beard be any more risky than the hair on my mustache that is allowed, or my sideburns if they're allowed? And let alone me, if one of the contact areas for boxing is the face, leave me hairless and you got eyelashes and eyebrows and you got a better chance of hair coming into my opponents, or even off my forearm, because wherever the gloves end, there's still hair on my arms possibly. And so, you know, these are things that people don't think about, but they'll have a judgment. And then when it's somebody who looks like me is the one challenging it, they'll even be racist judgments, right? And so those become a lot of different issues. It's unfortunate because it almost cost me my life, right? I was attacked and my life was threatened. And, you know, you're just inches away from somebody actually stabbing me with the scissors or cutting me up with the razor. That's the fine line.
You know, the idea of you being attacked and people being so opposed to change is really why I think all the work you do kind of comes together, and why we need to have these conversations and you know, educate ourselves and educate young people about human rights and about issues beyond, you know, what we're talking about here, but about reconciliation, about the climate.
Yeah, I'll give you another example too. Sarana, you know, like again, you know, I've been working with some leaders in the U.S. who've been trying to advocate, for example, Sikhs entering the military as they've been serving for centuries. In fact, one of the largest per capita serving groups for Sikhs in World War One and Two. Right. So this is technically nothing new for us as a people and us as a community. And the U.S., you know, just like in some other places, they again, this beard and beard rules come up and they talk about, no, and, you know, it's camaraderie and this and that, and it's a concept of group and this and that. And, you know, we can't have people doing this and what are we going to do that? Forget us asking for an exemption. The U.S. military already offers thousands of exemptions every year to non-Sikhs for the beard. And yet they still can't make that transition to understand what this looks like as a concept of human rights and an accommodation for Sikh community to join the different ranks of the military, right? And army and navy with a beard. Where's the logic? Where's the logic once you bring that up to somebody saying, now what is your counter argument of why a Sikh can't have a beard in the military? Because non-Sikhs already have it by the thousands as exemptions. Yeah. Makes no sense.
Sounds so silly to me even to think about that, you know?
Yeah, but they're still fighting it.
Yeah,
they're still fighting it year after year. And so then what gives? What gives? And that's why I've said, just like I said, at one point then, once all the logic and the merit and the rationalization and everything else gets quashed, then the only thing holding it is racism and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And it has to be called out. It has to be named. Because mm-hmm. there's no other justification of holding that stance.
Well, I was watching an NFL game on Sunday, and this one player had hair longer than mine sticking out of the helmet. So I asked my husband, I said, he can have long hair like that? Doesn't it like get yanked, or, you know, shouldn't he tie it up? Like, isn't it dangerous? Yeah. And he said, well, he's allowed to have that long hair and it's seen as part of the uniform. So actually other players can pull it as part of the tackle. Okay, cool. Right. I'm only worried about that guy, but, you know, speaking about racism, who gets to be afforded those privileges to have the long hair, to have the beard, you know, yeah. And, or when it's trending. So, and I'm glad you mentioned this idea of, you know, the racism in sports and kind of who gets to be an athlete. And I wanted to ask you about that, about, you know, what do you think your history with sport in Canada tells us about what it means to be a Canadian athlete, and who gets to be one, and then who gets to be celebrated as one?
And so, again, when you look at these aspects, right, sometimes just access to sports is an issue to even start competing and stuff. And then, you know, you look at the history and there's no shortage in the 1800s of phenomenal Black players. And if you looked at that trajectory and you ask, well, what happened? And why aren't they filling the ranks of our junior teams and our national teams when it comes to the World Cup of Juniors and stuff, and then the next tier into the NHL. And then you're talking about not only that for athletes, well, okay, but you don't think there can be great coaches as well? Where, for example, are Black coaches in the NHL? I think right now, if I'm correct, the NHL does not have a single Black coach, but they've been playing hockey for over 100 years. And so you can see all the layers of players getting time, getting playing time, getting selected, getting drafted. Those are all other layers in addition to even sometimes just access to. And so again, those are the types of things you ask yourself, of the whys and the why nots, and look at a number of different factors, because there's no way, if we just look at this concept of meritocracy, to think that that statistically can hold the way it is in terms of demographics, for example, in a number of different sports.
And I'm glad you said that, because we do have to work on actually thinking about that. And we have to do our own research and dig deeper to find those athletes.
And just a prime example, again, in terms of the sport and really, you know, look at the Indigenous community, right? Mm-hmm. And hockey, they love playing hockey as well. And again, statistically, looking at that issue, you're looking at, again, for coaching. And then you look at Ted Nolan and his whole piece that he just wrote a book right now. I don't think there's a single coach of the year that's available for a coaching job that has not ever been not interviewed except for Ted Nolan. Again, beyond dumbfounded, there's something deeper going on. And the NHL still needs to ask itself, and it's hiding. It's mm-hmm. hiding. And again, look at the NHL claiming to about diversity, and then when the players create their first diversity group, that's the group that the NHL doesn't want to kind of speak with, negotiate with, partner with. They want to create their own, because right. that's if this and yet that should have been the first group. And then you look at incidents have happened since that time. You look at issues around the Pride yeah. tape, right? Yeah. Okay, you look at Marc-Andre Fleury and the mask and almost trying to deny him the right to wear a mask to honor Indigenous heritage of his own wife. And it doesn't need to be his wife. If he wants to honor Indigenous heritage, he should be allowed to, because these people honor their cats and dogs and anything else on these goalie masks and helmets. And then they want to fine him, right? And then they realized what the real uproar was. You look at like team names and stuff like that. You look like Cleveland Guardians and what they were for way too long. Mm-hmm. And then the logo of how mm-hmm. racist that logo was, and why did it exist mm-hmm. even in 2005, even in 2010? Ask yourself, how could it even exist? And then you look at other ones saying, oh, the community kind of likes it, or we have this partnership, like Edmonton was trying to say with the Eskimos for the longest of time, stuff like that, because where you might even have within the community, but we know how inappropriate prerogative it may be and stuff like that. Because then you get like what used to happen with even around Atlanta and Atlanta Braves and stuff like that, that if that is nuanced in terms of that team name, it's what happens in the stadium that's still yes. racist. In terms of the chants and the taunts and the hand waves and everything else, right? And so you look at a number of different things like that, and how a group is depicted and how they're marginalized, how they're stereotyped, and how they're used for our entertainment and glorification. Mm-hmm. And somehow we think we're honoring them. There's no other community that will accept that type of honor.
Absolutely.
Because there is no honor in being mocked literally.
And I'm dumbfounded that some teams are still, for lack of a better word, allowed to have these derogatory names in their sporting.
Yeah, teams. and the allowed is only as long as we allow
it.
It's the fans allow it. It's the people that are sponsoring the stadiums or the teams, mm-hmm. right? It's the ownership and everything else. Because all this work, ultimately, at the highest level of what we're talking about, is about power and privilege. And unless you have the power above the highest level of power, whoever may be doing that discrimination or holding on to these team names, it's not going to change mm-hmm. because they have the power to not change it. And absolutely. It's only, for example, like Washington only got changed until literally the title sponsor of the stadium and everything else is going to bring a lot of income for that owner to sustain its team, had decided, we don't think we want to give you our name anymore and be attached to this name of this team and stuff like that. Did they switch? Right. Because these people haven't done it on their own goodwill.
Of course. It's power, politics, privilege, all of it. Money. Yeah. And when you talk about this, I have to bring it back to your amazing exhibit. So Five Rivers to Five Lakes, from Five Rivers to Five Lakes, you know, you held it at the Sea Heritage Museum of Canada. And for me, it was a showcase of what it means to be a Canadian athlete. And a Canadian, because you showed, you know, your experience with boxing and running, you know, you showed your toy soldier collection, You showed some of your medals and accolades, your collection of Adidas garb, all of that. But it was really beautiful and honestly wonderfully curated experience of this intertwinement of sports and human rights and Sikhism and what it means to be you, Pradeep. And so I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about everything we've talked about today and how that connects to your inspiration and perhaps objective even, if there was one, to curating the beautiful exhibit that you did in November.
Well, you know, first of all, and we touched upon a couple of different aspects to what is my journey? What did it look like? For me, it was about how do I showcase the 50 years, right? And start with, for lack of a better word, the origin story, right? Where was I born? And I was born in Punjab, Punj meaning five, Jab meaning rivers. So I was born in the land of the five rivers. And what is that family story? What is that migration story? And then where did we settle? We settled in Ontario, you know, surrounded by the five lakes. And that's where the title of the exhibition comes from. And then, you know, coming, before I even speak of Canada, I speak about reconciliation, right? And so after introducing the concept of Punjab and born heritage and lineage, you know, I speak about reconciliation. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, that I brought the theme of water into that aspect as well and speaking to it. And again, making sure people have an understanding of where I sit, where I land, where I play for a number of different things on this aspect of things that are important to me and it should be important to all Canadians, right? And then speaking about what is this Canada, right? It's and Canada's, you know, sometimes always defined by me as a rose, right? We think about a beautiful rose and its smell and everything else attached to it, in addition to the thorns, right? And the branches and everything else. And what does it look like? What does it feel like? What do we celebrate? How do we celebrate? Who defines this concept of Canada and the nation? And how do we see it? And as if being Canadian in any one of those identities is mutually exclusive, which it's not. And then, you know, speaking to some of my journeys, you talked about the marathon and what have you, the area of family and friends, which is the most important piece for me, right? And all threaded through the theme of three stripes and Adidas and aspects of my cars and lowriders and car collecting itself, going down memory lane. What did it mean to be growing up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s? And just poignant things and moments and experiences. So I shared that out as part of the exhibit. Again, there was an ode to some of the patriarchs and matriarchs of the family itself too. There was being anointed the title of Adidas ambassador by Stan Smith and the letter from Stan Smith and everything else. And that area of the exhibit, there was the Lego areas that you talked about. My son loves playing Lego. We all have affinity with some aspect of Lego and some of the partnerships with Adidas and Lego and what have you. And then obviously the Addy addicted part of Adidas and a lot of interesting artifacts and collections that I have and stuff shared out through there. The aspects of human rights and you look at individuals like we mentioned, different aspects and people through that struggle of human rights from Bob Marley to Nelson Mandela, to other individuals that have influenced me around that work. For example, Chief Little Child, and then areas of the boxing and my chance to pay an ode and homage to my coach and the family and the boxing club family, and my experiences through the boxing itself. And then talking about the film Tiger and then honoring the original Tiger in terms of my soccer team that I grew up playing with. And so a lot of aspects that way, you know, the pop culture of Adidas, you know, Run DMC in the 80s and the Shelto shoe and the My Adidas song and the legend of Adidas being even wider and bigger. And then how it manifested through many other artists, including individuals like Pharrell and Missy Elliott and, you know, other partnerships with Beyonce and Ivy Park and all those aspects as well. you know, creating a whole bunch of different mementos and cards and stuff like that. And then the photo booth having different things for props, including Run DMC glasses and hats and chains and just other props itself too. A reflective book as well. The cars, my cars were part of the exhibit before you even came physically inside, right? So I had one of my cars wrapped with Adidas theme itself. I got license plates, three stripes in my Adidas that are mine as part of that. And so I'm having fun with some of that as well, including my car that's license plate is Boxing, B-O-X-S-I-N-G-H, to a play on both my middle name and boxing itself. So just having fun with the exhibit. But at the end of the day, it was less about what you in part experienced, kind of walking through that, immersing yourself. And for me, it was about connecting with family and friends, and in some cases, even strangers, as part of the experiential. And that's what was most important. I had, friends and family from friends from kindergarten class, you know, over 45 years ago, colleagues from some of the very first places that I've ever worked, you know, 30 years ago. Right up to colleagues who had just joined me in the board about a month earlier and said, hey, you got to get out here, right, and come join and see and stuff like that. And so really that's what it was more about, was bringing community together, get a chance to celebrate us, because when you came to the exhibit, we came as Canadians, and we get to kind of see through many different lenses that connect and resonate with us.
I love that. And you know, I've known you for so many years, and I know a little bit about, or I have made assumptions of, why you love, or shall I say, are obsessed with Adidas. But where did this begin? Because I've been dying to ask you. I mean, you know, you had like postcards of Adidas. I think you had the Adidas rep you introduced me to, who was there. Like, where did this start, besides the letter from Stan Smith? Where did this start?
So first of all, it's interesting because even that, I think a lot of people don't know. First of all, you know, technically, Adidas was the primary athletic wear and gear for all athletes. You know, you look at 60s Olympics, 70s Olympics, that whatever sport, your pole vault shoes, your running shoes, your skates, you just name any sport, and soccer and any other sport that was going on around the world. Adidas was the primary, for lack of a better word, outfitter for athletic wear and athletic gear, including shoes and what have you. And so that's what we grew up. Growing up in the 70s, playing soccer, I wanted Adidas soccer shoes. That was like the cream of the crop, so to speak, in terms of what you wanted as an athlete and stuff. So that's where the affinity came as an athlete, was to have the great gear attached to all athletes, right? And so that was Adidas. The other brand really only came into primary existence in the mid 80s, late 80s, right? And took off a little bit more once Michael Jordan joined them. But overall, and even still today, you know, Adidas is well known as just leisure wear in Europe, outside of it, athletic wear in of itself. And then so in the 80s, one of the t-shirts I got was Mr. Adidas. And then that's where the moniker kind of literally started. And there was a letter at the exhibit where some young kids in the neighborhood who I lent them, I guess, some games to play, and they broke it. And they wrote in the letter, "Dear Mr. Adidas, we're sorry for it," right? And so you see how elongated that was through that thing. And then it became just part of who and what I am. And I just played with it because I play with it. As much as people think my infatuation or affinity in it, it's just more having fun with it more than anything else. And so it got to a point where I remember with some friends had this kind of deal that, well, I'll wear Adidas every single day. So there'll be never a single day that you'll see me without some Adidas socks or shoes or track pants or top or t-shirt or something, right? Watch, anything, right? And then, like I said, just had fun with it, right? And still having fun with it. And I want to leave it at that, right? In the sense that, just like anything else in life, we started this conversation on human rights. And if you're asking me what's more important, Adidas or human rights, there's not even a question. It's night and day, right? And so I don't forget what's critical, what's important, and what should really, truly take my time, my energy, and my resources. But along that journey, you can have some fun. And then also you can make those connections, right? Because, like, so for example, a huge human rights advocate, Nelson Mandela, had a collaboration with Adidas, right, on the 4664. Bob Marley and Adidas and a whole bunch of other ones that you've seen at the exhibit, right? So then you can even find those intersectionalities as part of those. Yeah.
I also know that you have a large collection of Sikh toy soldiers. Tell us about those toy soldiers and maybe which one's your favorite.
The Sikh toy soldiers are just part of a larger piece of my interest in terms of Sikh history and artifacts of Sikhs in Canada and around the world. And, you know, one of the interesting things, just as for any listener, is probably the same thing that I had. What? There's actually Sikh toy soldiers? And, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier in terms of our contributions from a military tradition that spans centuries, not just decades. But in addition to that, to know that there's toy manufacturers that produced different regiment, Sikh regiments of toy soldiers. So it's just fascinating to see. And again, like a number of things when people always ask whether it's cars or these toy soldiers, if I do have a favorite, I don't think I have a favorite because each one is unique in terms of either the regiment they represent, the details that are on them, or the manufacturer. And so there's so many different aspects of it. I would say right now, the King and Country sets that I have are pretty stellar in terms of just in terms of their aesthetics and quality, right? So those really resonate with people as part of my toy soldier collection.
I love that. I just love how so multifaceted and like you have so many different parts of you, and I love that. You know, you've got more than three stripes, of course, but had to use that pun. But so many different and so many different loves, and I think that's so amazing. And what makes you who you are, right, Pradeep? You've got just so many intricate loves and hobbies and interests and commitments. It's just really, really great. Speaking of which, you love some charities like the CN Tower Climb and the Polar Bear Dip, which you do every year. What got you into that? And, you know, how do you kind of see yourself as a Sikh Canadian and the aspect of volunteerism? What role does that play in your life? As well as your role in reconciliation, as you've talked about in this podcast today, with various Indigenous communities of Canada. Tell us a little bit about, you know, those ideas of volunteerism in community and then those kind of big events like the CN Tower Climb and the Polar Bear Dip and what they mean to you.
Yeah, and so first of all, you know, on the one hand, it's our civic responsibility. It's the price we pay for having an opportunity to live on this earth and have a life for however long it is for us. It's the minimum responsibility. There are many of us that may be watching this podcast or listening to it that also can understand it from maybe a theological perspective. You know, within the Sikh community, we have a concept of thus one, thus meaning 10, van the means to share a tenth of your earnings. And our responsibility is not just in terms of sharing our earnings or our wealth, but also our time, our expertise, our knowledge. And so for me, these are non-negotiables, right? So there will never be a time that as long as I'm alive, I am not committed to giving of something that I have and sharing it out, sharing my knowledge. But if I got a degree, why don't I share that knowledge degree and not just for use it to make a living? And then even if I am making a living, then share part of what I'm making as a living, right? Because I always say we make a living by what we get, my salary. We make a life by what we give. When we give of our time, our knowledge, our expertise, and when I'm saying time, just think about what it means for us when we're talking about family or friends. What's most valuable for us in our friendships? Time, right? And equally, what's most needed in society as well, too. Sometimes give of your time as well. And so I've given locally, I've given provincially, giving nationally now, serving on the Board of Trustees with the Canadian Museum of Human Rights on a volunteer basis. And when you're talking about things like the Polar Bear Dip and CN Tower, I laugh because that's too easy. Like, it's one thing to volunteer, and it's another thing to volunteer and have fun. That's even too easy.
Yeah. Right?
Like, you're telling me the CN Tower stair climb where I can invite friends or family to get together on a Saturday morning to, first of all, get together, say hi, good morning, how are you, what's happening, connect, reconnect. Okay, number one. Number two, do something positive, productive. Right. And number three, raise money for something greater than me. Mm-hmm. And number four, have fun while we do it. Either mm-hmm. compete with ourselves for fastest time or laugh at it afterwards and go out for a brunch and enjoy each other's company and laugh and talk and share stories and reconnect. That's too easy. That kind of volunteering is too easy because I didn't do anything. I just showed up literally. Someone else organized the stair climb. Absolutely. Someone else is organizing the check-in and everything else. What do I need to do? Literally show up, right? Absolutely. Pull over a dip. Again, technically speaking, all I did was to show up. And prior to that, send an email out. Hey, folks, you got one of two options. You're either jumping in with me and joining the team, or you're sponsoring me. Now, come on, let's be honest. How much effort did that technically really require for me to raise? And I think we finished third in terms of top fundraising teams. And I like that number three because of Adidas and Three Stripes. Obviously, wouldn't want to be number one or number two. And I have been for many other years and stuff. But, you know, I think I raised over $1,000 myself as part of our team aspect. And what did it require? Networking out through my email. That's as far as I usually go on social media, right? Is an email contact list. But people have it, and you can do it through your Facebook or through your Instagram and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's how are you using those tools, and when are you using those tools, and how you can use them for good? I always think about what kind of, how I want to run into the water, or what I want to run into the water with or dress up as. And this year, you know, it was Elvis, right?
Great costume.
Right. And just to say that, even that, because, you know, other people say, scared, I'll never do it. I go, do it. I'm not only doing it, I'm going in costume, right? I'm going to have some fun with it as well. And so it's just a matter of then showing up, raise funds to show up. And so when you really ask about this kind of stuff, that these are what I call a low-hanging fruit of volunteering, right? And doing work. It's actually showing up. You know, having too much fun raising money, right? When you really think about it, having too much fun raising money for charity, honestly. Right. And we're still talking about it. And I'll be talking about it all the way up to next year. And I'll even talk about it for years, because then people say, well, this one I like the best, and I like this outfit of yours, but I can't believe you did this or what have you. Right.
And you bring other people along, although those are probably, I do a lot of volunteer work, but those are probably the two most daunting activities for me. I know, like, one day I will join you, but they seem so daunting. Like, to your point, all you gotta do is just show up, but.
Yeah, but the daunting is, again, we are our biggest barriers. Daunting was the same thing for Black History Month. Why are we not participating is, well, who told you to not invite, right? Who told you can't run into water? Who told you don't want to walk in? So I'll guarantee you, when you're a young kid, none of them were daunting. In fact, your parents had to bring you in when it was raining outside.
Okay,
if you're around a lake or a pond or Wasaga Beach, you probably were wanting to run into those places in Vancouver, if that's where you grew up and stuff like that, right? Around water. And your parents will have to almost safely try to keep you out of it, right? Stairs, you're probably running up and down the stairs at work and at home, and your parents are probably saying, stop running up and down the stairs, or you probably got in trouble at school running down the high hallways. So then what happens? Age is supposed to make you wiser.
I know, right?
Yeah.
No, all of that. No, and you really are inspiration. You know, for folks listening, you know, I've known you for, I guess, I want to say, maybe 15 years. I can't really, I have to put it down. Maybe 12 to 15 years. I have to really think about it. But you're an inspiration to me and to a lot of people that you work with. And you've done a lot of work for, you know, people like me, bringing us up in the education system and mentoring us and leading us. And so I want to thank you for all the work you've done for, you know, racialized, Indigenous and Black educators as well. You do a lot of work out of the goodness of your heart, or what we call seva, right? In our language, seva as service. And so that hasn't gone unnoticed. And you're really an inspiration in everything that you do, from just kind of showing up, like you said, to getting in that cold water. Because you want to represent that, and I appreciate that. And I wanted to know, before we get to our last question, is there anything else that we haven't spoken about? I mean, there's so much we could talk about that you would like to share with our listeners and that you want them to know before we close.
Yeah, I've always told people to really, you know, kind of step back and get civically engaged, right? Mm-hmm. It's critically important. I know I kind of spoken about it, but I can't speak about it enough. And that's why I'll repeat that mantra. And so two responsibilities, civic engagement and reconciliation. If those two things are the only two things that are always on our bucket list, and continue to be on our bucket list to do more and more and more, then we have the best bucket available to us.
I love that. Thank you. And then the last question is, can you tell our listeners and tell me what brings you joy?
You know, I don't necessarily seek joy. I seek accountability. I seek responsibility. I think one of the postcards that I had in the early days from when I used to box, and I said, you know, I can't believe that the purpose of life is to be happy. I think the purpose of life is to be responsible, to be accountable, to have made some difference at all. And that's where the joy comes from, through responsibility and accountability, because otherwise, to be honest with you, that's when I feel less complete as an individual, if I'm not engaging in the responsibility that I should have. And so that's what makes me whole. And when I'm whole, that's when I'm joyful, even in sometimes the most difficult of circumstances, and not having any barriers then, right? If you want to talk about the ultimate state of joyfulness, is that you can celebrate death and say the name and remember and honor and talk and engage and console and comfort, enjoy. And you can also celebrate a birth with the same aspects itself too. And that's really what it is. And so what that joy is and where it ultimately fundamentally comes from, because the other stuff would be superficial joy for me. If I talk about those aspects bring me joy, and I'm looking this way, but I have no accountability towards reconciliation, what is that real joy then? And so for me, I wouldn't feel complete as an individual, and I wouldn't authentically be able to say, I'm living a joyful life, right? A joyful life is one that's accountable and responsible. And through that accountability and responsibility, there's much joy to be had.
Yeah, that's a very important message, something I'm going to reflect on, actually, you know, to think about that. Joy is accountability. And for folks listening, where can they learn more about your work? And of course, the big joke is you don't do social media, but you recently got Instagram. So where can folks follow your work, learn more about you, learn more about the Sikh Heritage Museum, all of that? And we'll put them in the show notes as well, but just tell our listeners where they can find you.
So as much as you claim I'm not on social media, I think if you type even just my first name into Google, the very first thing that pops up is my website, pardeep.ca, pardeep.ca. And then the very first thing when you're on my website is the phone. And that's this right over here that I'm holding. And so I don't think you can be any more successful. And why I say this is because I challenge this against so-called influencers, social media people. Try to get a hold of anybody that's an influencer that has 10 million followers, and let me know if you can just literally write their first name, find them on social media right away, pop up, and the website has a cell phone number, and then you call it, and I actually answer the phone. So I can't be more accessible and more direct and more available to anybody in the world at any given time to contact me via phone or via email, because the email address is there as well. Through the website, just to learn a little bit more about me. I'm not one of those fans to say follow me and see what I'm doing and see what I've done, as you know, and that's because I humbly say that there should be enough on the website as it stands today to inspire you to do something, positive and productive. And what I'm doing, it shouldn't be the reason why you need to see, because did I do enough this year for you to maybe get off your butt and do something? Or do you need me to do more? Or are you going to say, oh, wow, oh, I love this guy's videos or TikToks. He's so inspiring. Inspiring for what? If whatever I do has not motivated you to go around and feed the homeless this year, then there's nothing I've done. You're just happy for those moments looking at me and smiling and nodding and feeling good about yourself for watching me, but have done nothing yourself. Right. And so for me, it's not about that. And so I don't need followers. I don't want followers. Right. I want doers. So if you can find a social media platform for which I'm there and it's called the Doers and everybody else is there as part of me, I'm game. But for me alone, like I said, that's not what it's about. And so I'd rather be part of community and be present as doers.
I love that. And you are a rare gem, Pradeep. You're just a rare gem, honestly. That's all I can say about it, because there's not a lot of people like you around. And again, you're inspiring in everything you do, from, you know, the volunteer work you do, from the Three Stripes love, from your exhibit, and from just your beauty and what you exude to the world. So thank you so much for taking this time to sit down with us at Curated Leadership on Curated Conversations. And, you know, we look forward to having you back for part two. Thank you again for joining us. And thank you for
part of the deal.
Yes, part two.
Right? Do three. I'm not going to leave it at two. Then it's going to be three, right?
We're going to. Well, it's got to be three stripes. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you again for joining me today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Curated Conversations. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share the podcast. Subscribe at our website, createdleadership.com, and listen wherever you listen to podcasts. You can stay connected. Pay attention for this episode to drop at our Instagram at Curated Leadership, and really, really do think about what one thing is that you will do to change the world and to really practice the work of reconciliation as Pradeep has shared with us today. Thank you so much.
And not even change the world, it's make a difference.
Yes, make a difference. Yes.